Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to another episode of Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. Whenever possible, we try to put together a theme show. This week is not one of those weeks.
Hello.
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 Hi, Mom.
Who is it?
It's your son.
Say again?
It's your son with Radio K's Real College Podcast.
Who are you with?
Radio K's Real College Podcast.
I'm on Real College Podcast?
Yeah.
Why?
I have a quick question to ask.
Okay, what question?
Do you remember Cockapitsy?
Do I? Yes.
Could you explain what it is?
Sure. Right now?
Yeah, real quick.
Okay. So Cockapitsy was created by your cousin, Sissy Feldman, and it's like a dinner you put together that's a little of this and a little of that, so it could be like whatever you have in your refrigerator, like, leftover chicken and some, canned peaches.
Yeah.
And it could be, like crackers and cheese, Cockapitsy.
Right. So Sissy just totally made it up.
She totally made it up, yeah.
Actually, after some further Googling, it turns out Cockapitsy is an old Yiddish word meaning a conglomeration. Yeah, that's kind of what the episode's going to be like today. So.
The episode's going to be Cockapitsy?
Yeah, it's a little Cockapitsy episode.
Oh, that's going to be good. Okay. Yeah. Sounds good.
All right. Well,
I hope that helps.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. That's right. We've got a real mix, a conglomeration, or a true Cockapitsy of stories coming your way this week. From classical music to the coronavirus, we've really got it all. Because sometimes the most unexpected things go well together. To get things started, new reporter John stepped out on the street to ask students a bit about their thrifting habits.
During my first year at the University of Minnesota, I began to observe varying styles and fashion choices of students all around campus. And with the increasing popularity and trendiness of thrift shopping over recent years, I was curious to find out the motive behind this form of shopping. Why do you choose to thrift shop over other more commercial avenues of shopping?
Obviously, the money is a big part of it, being a college student. But I think it also helps with reducing purchasing from fast fashion stores that aren't great for the environment or the economy or treating their workers correctly.
Yeah, I would agree. I think what's another bonus about thrift shops is, you'll find clothes that maybe aren't being mass-produced, and like you see them, every other person has the same jacket as you. Maybe you'll find your own unique style at a thrift shop.
I personally choose a thrift shop over commercial forms of shopping, mainly because, one, it's cheap. I'd like to say that I do it because I'm conscientious to the environment. That was not an original intention, although now I kind of subscribe to it because, hey, it benefits. Why do we need to make new clothes instead of recycling old ones that are dope, swaggy, and, cheaper than commercial clothes? And they last long, so that's why I thrift.
For me, it's kind of a money thing, first of all. To be honest, I'm just quite broke. I'm in college. I'm not working at all, so literally, like, just being able to go out and buy clothes for that cheap just is so attractive to me. And also, like, usually when I do it now, it's it's on a weekend, it's on a Saturday, and it's me and just some close friends. And we're like, you know what? Like, let's just go see what's going on. Like, we don't even need to buy anything, really. Like, let's just go see what's there. Just go find something cool. Just go put on a hat. Just go, you know, take some photos with whatever the heck we can find. And, like, if we see something really dope, we're like, oh, yeah, like, let's go buy that. And, you know, like, there's no pressure. And it's just a fun, good time. It's all about the experience.
Thrift shopping provides certain uniqueness in the clothing, and other people usually don't have the clothes that I do when I thrift shop. And also, it's a great way to inexpensively shop.
Well, for one thing, I'm anti-corporation. I also just think it's more ethical, just because if you're buying secondhand, you're not directly purchasing from places that might use child labor or stuff like that.
On another note, after frequently walking down the hallways of Ferguson Hall, past the dozens of soundproof practice rooms that line either side, music reporter Casey McCabe was curious as to what the lives of all those music students are really like. Here's a peek into what's going on in those secluded practice rooms.
The U is home to an immensely diverse population of students, and other than our shared hatred of the cold and love of rowing the boat, it can sometimes be hard to find things in common. I have, however, found that no matter one's major or background, all Gophers share a love of music. For some, though, music isn't just part of their college experience, it defines it. I sat down with the director of the School of Music, Dr. Michael Kim, to get an idea of how many Gophers have devoted themselves to the study of music and what their curriculum is like.
I think the number of undergraduates deviates, but I would say anywhere from 220 to 250 majors. But we have many more non-majors, so I don't know what the division is, but we have about 4,500 non-majors, and then in our marching band and our pep band, we have about 500 students total. I'm just going to talk, first of all, because I'm a performer myself, mm-hmm. Let's start by talking about the performance curriculum.
Yep, yep.
But I mean, you have to take lessons, mm-hmm. You have to take music theory, you have to take music history, you have general ed requirements, and then you have ear training, you have ensemble requirements. And because we're accredited by the National Association of Schools of Music, we have to follow a specific curriculum. Mm-hmm. So I think as we move forward, whether you're music ed, whether you're going to be a theorist or musicologist or music therapy, you will find that these are the common curricular links. And I think that's what kind of makes us unique in general.
Dr. Kim then went on to explain how a degree from the School of Music plays into one's success post-college.
Well, I think the wonderful thing about a music degree is it's extremely versatile. So just because you get a music degree doesn't necessarily, first of all, mean you have to become a musician. We know of many cases where somebody gets an undergraduate music degree and they move on to be a very successful lawyer, they move on to be a very successful doctor. In other cases, there's so many different competencies and skills you gain from it. So, I mean, in performing arts, you have performing arts careers, obviously. You can work as a musician in an orchestra, you can freelance, you can also teach. There's K-12 education. You can also be a music therapist. You can be in academia as a musicologist or theorist or an ethnomusicologist. There's so many different careers you can have in music.
As we all know, college students are very busy, but according to Dr. Kim, music majors are some of the busiest.
Well, I think it's safe to say that music majors are among the busiest people I know. And it's interesting that you draw the parallel to athletics, because I like drawing that parallel. You know, our student athletes have to work really hard, they have to be really disciplined, yet maintain a strong academic profile. In the same way, if you're an instrumentalist, you have to practice a certain number of hours per day, you have to go to ensembles and participate in these large ensembles and small ensembles. So there's a tremendous amount of collaboration that takes place. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I think music majors have to work very, very hard, because they have to maintain, you know, the very practical, almost athletic skills you have on your instruments and the different things. And then the academic skills are, especially in this R1 institution, are equally important in terms of the writing. So I think it's safe to say that they're busy. They're working all hours of the day.
If music majors are comparable to Gopher athletes, then the Symphony Orchestra ensemble performance on February 12th was their game against Wisconsin. The performance featured Seong-Yung Kim, this year's piano concerto winner, as well as concertmaster and lead violinist James Martinez. After the show, I got to chat with James and gain an understanding of what being in the School of Music is like.
I probably practice about 4 hours a day. I'm here all the time. All my friends are here. You know, it's kind of like its own little city itself. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say that I know anything else but this, you know. I mean, I feel cheesy to say that it's like everything, you know. But it's literally like everything I do. Mm-hmm. You know, just before the concert started, I'm sitting in there looking out into the audience before anybody came, thinking like, oh, this is so cool. You know, what a life that I get to, you know, be on a stage and... in this case, walking out to people clapping, you know. Exactly. It's pretty wild. It's pretty cool. I mean, for me, at least as a doctoral student, my classes are pretty much all centered around playing, performing. So I haven't sat in a class since maybe like last semester. I'm being a little dramatic. I mean, it's fun, so why not, you know?
The next School of Music performances at Ted Mann will be on Saturday, February 29th and Tuesday, March 3rd, and will start at 7 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. respectively. The show on the 29th will feature the school's first and second jazz ensembles, while the performance on the 3rd will feature the symphonic band. All concerts put on by the University School of Music are free for students. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I am Casey McCabe.
The coronavirus is so far the big news of 2020, and it doesn't seem to be showing any signs of going away anytime soon. Yet, for all the coverage, we often miss out on important facts about the disease and how it might affect us here in the U.S. Ben Hallam has more.
Coronavirus. A new disease centered in the city of Wuhan in China's Hubei province has been dominating headlines for months. But just what is coronavirus? Where does it come from, and how can we expect it to develop in the future? To get the answers to some of these questions, I spoke with Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota.
This virus is being transmitted very much like an influenza virus, which is a respiratory transmitted virus that is easily transmitted to people. And it's one that, because of our modern world of transportation and movement, can quickly be around the world. The virus is now in at least 24 different countries.
As coronavirus continues to spread, a key question for many is, how deadly is this disease? And how much should we worry about it? Here's Dr. Osterholm discussing how the deadliness of coronavirus compares to that of other respiratory viruses.
To understand the severity of this disease, one has to just look at how it compares to other diseases. About 2% of the cases appear to be dying. SARS killed 10%, MERS 25 to 30%. So, in fact, you can say, well, it's much less severe than MERS or SARS. The difference is it's spreading like influenza. It's a likelihood that many, many, many millions of people could become infected. And when you look at that and compare it to the only real model we have, which is influenza itself, it would be much, much more severe than a seasonal flu year, even a bad one. And it could very well begin to compare to really a bad pandemic of influenza. And that's what we're confronted with right now.
Despite the possibility of deaths on the scale of pandemic influenza, Dr. Osterholm was skeptical of the ability of governments to stop the spread of the disease, especially through the use of quarantines and border checks.
When you look at a virus like this, it's very different than we even saw with SARS or MERS, where there the highest level of infectiousness occurred in the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th days of illness. So that if someone became ill, you could actually get them into the hospital, isolate them in a room, and you could also have healthcare workers wear protective equipment. In this case, cases are infectious early in their illness and may even be to the point of where mild to what we call asymptomatic people are capable of transmitting the virus. You know, that's a virtually impossible situation to stop. I mean, imagine, does anyone ever talk about trying to stop seasonal flu? So I have been very suspicious from the get-go that airport screening, border closings, and quarantines would make much of a difference.
Beyond being simply ineffective, these quarantines have the capacity to actually impede responses to the virus. I spoke to Karthik Natarajan, a professor at the Carlson Business School at the University of Minnesota, about the possible effects that these quarantines and other impacts of coronavirus could have on the logistics of an effective response and on the global economy.
In case of disease outbreaks, we have never seen situations where 70, 80 million people were put under quarantines. So entire cities, entire regions have been put under quarantine. And that makes it extremely complicated to provide a response. And that is something that we are already seeing. For example, in Wuhan, there is numerous complaints that health workers and nurses and doctors don't have access to masks and bodysuits that they actually need. And that is because it's so hard to get products into the region because of these quarantines. So even if you wanted, getting these products to areas, hospitals that need them, that is difficult at the moment. So this is a very...
According to Professor Natarajan, the impacts of these quarantines could actually ripple out through the economy and affect more than just the logistical response to the coronavirus. They could also lead to a global slowdown of production in areas which rely on parts manufactured in China, in areas like the automotive industry, electronics, and consumer goods.
So the economic impact of this virus has the potential to be significant. There is many, many different suppliers who are in the Wuhan area. So a good example is the automotive industry. So Nissan in Japan has stopped production in their plants because they're not able to get components from China. Same has happened with South Korea. So this is, you know, we are seeing disruptions in so many different supply chains. So the impact is hard to predict for two reasons. One is if the companies who are impacted, if they're able to find alternate suppliers, then the impact might be less. And the second important factor is how long this is going to last. And nobody knows the answer to this. So if it lasts for another month, we probably will be able to recover. We probably won't see too much disruptions. But if this goes on for another 3-4 months, then we will definitely start seeing impacts here in the US in terms of products not being on the shelf or things becoming more expensive.
But even if the virus does spread around the world, the key measures you can take as an individual are the same as for the flu. Wash your hands, and if you feel sick, stay home. For the Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
If you've ever said cheese, you're probably aware of how awkward getting your picture taken can be. For photographers in documentary, journalism, or fine art, one way to get around this awkwardness is to take candid photos. But it's a practice which can cause tensions and raise ethical concerns. I listened in and somewhat candidly recorded the experience of one such photographer.
Yeah, for sure. I was over at the intersection of Franklin and Nicolette, so kind of over on Eat Street, and I was just walking up and down Nicolette and looking for interesting people, just kind of documenting whatever was going on. And this guy was walking past me, and I was walking, and then I just like kind of put the camera kind of over and took a picture of him, and it was kind of in front of him. So it was pretty noticeable. I think at that point I was getting a little bit more daring with my photos because no one had been.
Evelyn is a student here at the University of Minnesota, studying, among other things, photography. Early on in one of her intro to photography classes, the instructor assigned the class to go out and shoot some on-the-street photos.
So I took the picture, and he was like, hey, like...
Hey, did you take my picture?
And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm just, like, going around, like, photographing on the street. And then he got pretty mad, and he asked me if I could delete it. So I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I actually can't. It's on film. I can't delete it. And then he just got really mad at me and was like, you can't be out here taking people's picture, not asking them. That's not okay. And just kind of going off, and it kind of escalated from there, and I ran away.
The first time I heard this story from Evelyn was sitting in my living room along with some other friends of ours. She posed the question,
Yes.
Is it wrong to take someone's picture without their consent?
Yeah. I would say yes.
Yes? Yeah.
Yes.
I feel like...
Yeah, it kind of is.
Most of us were quick to say yes. Yes, it's wrong to document someone without their permission. I argued this even as I silently reached into my coat and pressed record on my Voice Memos app.
I'm kind of conflicted about it because, I don't know, I mean, technically it's legal to, like, photograph if you're like in public, like on public property, but some people obviously don't want their photo taken and they're like not about it. My issue is that if I ask someone's permission to take their photo, then I'm not going to get the photo that I wanted, because people tend to get really awkward in front of the camera, and that's usually not what I'm looking for when I'm taking someone's picture.
Candid photography, we're really looking for moments, right? Something that's happening right in front of us. And one of the things I think great photographers do is they really catch a moment and stop it, right? And let us look at it.
Really interesting. I mean, sometimes I just know I got a good shot, you know, and that's a really good feeling.
I'm Regina McCombs. I'm the Senior Fellow for Visual Communication and Photojournalism and a lecturer at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Comm. Sort of the more formal photography, you know, you ask people to pose, right? So portraits are posed. There's some really beautiful, interesting portraits out there. Portraits can be fabulous as art, as photojournalism, as documentary, but it's a different kind of thing, and that people are connecting with the camera, right? They're not unaware of the camera. They are very aware of the camera. So both are legitimate. They're just very different kinds of forms.
Is there anything like in particular that you've experienced that like you can capture in a candid photo but you would not be able to capture in a staged photo or a more portrait situation?
I think showing relationships is much more difficult in portraits. So showing how one person engages with another, those are the kinds of things that are much more difficult to get in a sort of situation where people are super aware.
I was like, I don't know if that was wrong of me, but it was definitely wrong of
him. I mean,
there are two different areas, right? There's the law and there's ethics. So the first question is it legal? You know, public places, it's almost always legal for you to take pictures. If anyone could be taking a picture with their phone at any time, it's typically, you know, perfectly legal for you to do that. It is not legal in private spaces, right, where people have an expectation of privacy. And that would include using a long telephoto lens to look into someone's house. That would be essentially an invasion of privacy without their permission. So that's the law. Then the ethics are much more often around intent.
Hey, did you take my picture?
Even if they're not, like, if you're feeling really down and out, like,
poverty porn. Picture? It's poverty porn.
Yeah, you know, probably.
Pictures. You know how people like take pictures of like homeless people?
Yeah.
Poverty porn.
That's what that is.
I don't like that.
It's like fucked up.
I'm not like for that. I don't know.
I've never even heard of that saying.
I've never heard that saying before.
So I was like, oh, no, nope, that's not what it is. Like, I don't know. That was so weird.
Kira is another friend who I caught on tape sitting in my living room that night.
Like, what do you think of, like, the words, or, like, the words poverty porn?
The word poverty porn? I think that it fetishizes it in a way. And it's, like, disgusting because poverty is a real thing, and it's embarrassing. And, like, you would never know, like, some people, like, can't take showers, can't get their haircuts, like, you know? And you never know, like, why someone is taking a picture of you, to make fun of you. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, like, you never know. You see that shit all over Facebook. So it's like, yeah, you taking pictures, sure, you educate yourself, like, whatever. But it's not like these people want their pictures to be taken, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's just my thoughts.
I've heard of sort of attaching porn to all kinds of different areas, you know, of people in distress, right, and taking their picture. So it's a question of, are you sort of using that to make yourself feel better, right? So that's one of the questions. And one of the questions, we talk about this a lot in journalism, right? Are you just looking in and sort of saying, look at these sad, poor people? Or are you saying, here's a real problem that we need to solve? Mm-hmm. You know, so I do think, again, it comes back to intent. And this is also where I think it's really important to make connection. Are you just passing by and snapping an image and throwing it up and saying, look what a cool picture I got of these sad, poor people? That is poverty porn, right? You are not trying to enrich their lives at all.
actually a good question because I really think it depends on the circumstances. Like, yeah, you can take the picture, but...
So, again, it partly comes to intent. Mm-hmm. This is for a class project. I don't feel like that's a huge sort of issue in the sense of you're not sort of taking advantage. But I do think you want to try to honestly engage people. And I don't know if this was a homeless person or if this just some guy on the street who didn't want his picture taken. I don't feel obligated to delete it. I would feel obligated to decide what was going to happen with that image. So why is it he was angry? What is it he's trying to protect? Is it relevant to a big issue that really needs coverage? But you only know this partly if you talk to people, right? So you really, it really pays to have some kind of engagement with people, as even if it's after the fact of taking the picture, mm-hmm. Which it often is, right? Often you take the picture because something's happening and you're seeing it and you're going to quick grab that moment, capture that moment. But you still need to sort of do the work of finding out who people are and names and why they're there, where they are, and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's hard work. People think taking a picture is easy, but actually the work around it is really hard work and important work.
Yeah, supernatural. Supernatural? Yeah. It's really interesting to see what people are okay with me witnessing and also me photographing. And I think that has a lot to do with my relationship with these people. I guess it's just more genuine, more raw in some ways, because it was just like a conversation that we were all having that night and we weren't really like thinking about it. Whereas right now I'm thinking a little bit more about what I'm saying, just knowing that it's on record, you know? Yeah.
That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the mix. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hollum, Tosin Fasimo, and Casey McCabe. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.